Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is Destination Moon, a special production from The Pulse marking the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. I'm Mikan Scott. It's July 20th, 1969.
I'm 14 years old. I'm one of seven kids. I'm like so excited that this is going to happen.
Katie Hunt is sitting on her neighbor's couch in Bronxville, New York, with a dachshund named Hildy. Everybody else has gone to bed, but she is way too excited to sleep.
I just kept running to the window and looking out going, oh my God, they're so far away. I can't see them. Oh my God, and I have to watch the TV.
1 minute to ignition and 13 minutes to landing.
It was unbelievable that we were actually going to do this.
Derek Pitts was also 14 years old that summer, living in Philadelphia. He's an astronomer now, but even back then he was obsessed with all things space.
I remember being at home in our mother's bedroom where she had a black and white television, and my brother and I watched as this took place, as the astronauts came out of the lunar module, went down the ladder, and stepped out onto the surface.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
It was a grainy image on television, and you could hear the conversation back and forth. You could hear the astronauts speaking from the moon through there with that sort of radio transmission voice that broke up every now and then, that really told you that it was live and happening.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
I had chill bumps just watching that and listening.
Sheila Oliver was watching the moon landing in Dallas, Texas.
And I can remember we would walk outside during kind of the course of that and look up and see the moon, and it just could not even get our brain around the fact that there were actually two men from the United States walking on that moon up there.
The moon landing was an incredible feat of science and technology, the will and effort of thousands of people coming together in one mission. On this episode, we'll explore how we got to the moon, the challenges along the way, and the promise of future space travel.
Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Blasting a manned rocket into space to get to the moon, land, and come back to Earth, all of it was a major risk.
A trip to the moon is such a long and fragile daisy chain of events.
That's Apollo 11 astronaut Michael Collins speaking at a panel hosted by the Explorers Club earlier this year.
Any little link in the chain that breaks, and that's the end of it. And there are so many of those events along the way.
President Nixon had prepared a backup speech in case the moon landing failed. Here's an actor reading the first few lines.
Fate has ordained that the men who went to the moon to explore in peace will stay on the moon to rest in peace. These brave men, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin, know that there is no hope for their recovery.
Nixon didn't have to give that speech, but it's clear why he was prepared.
Spaceflight was so demanding and so unforgiving, even if you're talking about the pre-launch preparations for a mission, that any misstep, any carelessness whatsoever can have terrible consequences.
That's Andrew Chaikin, a space journalist who's written books about the Apollo program. And just a couple of years before the moon landing, those terrible consequences had become real.
It was all over in one stunned, horrifying second.
Apollo 1, which was supposed to be a first manned mission to reach lower orbit, caught fire during a test simulation, killing the three astronauts who were trapped inside.
The flames enveloped Apollo 1, burning the couches, charring the spacesuits. The crewmen never had a chance.
The fire was a disaster that was brought on by a kind of blindness in which NASA was really amazingly unaware of the danger they had been putting the astronauts into. And that awareness was seared into NASA by the Apollo fire.
The tragedy led to a new level of care and precision. Safety became a top concern. The question, what if, haunted every simulation. But still, they knew that plenty could go wrong, especially when it came to their most ambitious mission yet. Liz Tung talked with Andrew about one part of Apollo 11 where failure was just seconds away.
In the last interview that Neil Armstrong ever gave, he revealed his greatest fear going into the moon landing mission.
I should say that I thought we had a 90% chance of getting back safely to Earth on that flight, but only a 50-50 chance of making a successful landing on the first attempt. There's so many unknowns.
Armstrong was famous for being a crack pilot, but landing on the moon is not like landing on Earth. According to Andrew Chaikin, it required a unique approach.
The landing on the moon basically called for Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin in their lunar lander to carry out what you could really call a controlled fall out of lunar orbit.
The idea was to fly low enough down out of orbit for the moon's gravity to grab them and pull them down to the surface. The problem was, unlike the Earth, the moon has almost no atmosphere, which means nothing to slow down their descent. Instead, once they'd gotten low enough, they would fire their engine and use the upward thrust to put on the brakes, and ideally, ease themselves down to the surface.
It really was a very unforgiving procedure, and the thing that made it the most difficult was that there was only enough fuel in the lunar lander for one try.
The lunar module, better known as the Eagle, needed to be as light as possible for them to get back off the moon, which meant just enough fuel for one perfect try.
Apollo 11. Good morning from the Black Team.
The lunar landing was scheduled for the fifth day of the mission, July 20th, 1969. Apollo 11's three crew members, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins, began their day together on the mission's mothership, the Columbia.
After having breakfast, the crew will have a rather busy day today.
Later that day, Armstrong and Aldrin crammed themselves into the lunar module, sealed the hatch, and undocked themselves from the Columbia.
Houston, you're looking good for separation. You're a go for separation, Columbia. Over.
Eagle separated from Columbia, and at that point came the first rocket firing that would begin the descent to the moon.
1 minute from the scheduled time for the descent orbit insertion maneuver.
It was a quick 30-second engine blast, designed to push them down out of orbit.
Eagle, Houston, you're a go for DOI, over.
It went well, but there was a problem.
The communications kept coming in and out.
Houston, Columbia, how well is this looking?
I say again, over.
And this was a distraction to the astronauts, and it was a tremendous worry to Gene Kranz, the flight director, and his team of controllers in Mission Control. They had to have communications, you know, to know if it was okay to continue with the descent, to even begin the descent.
Just as they reached 50,000 feet, Mission Control figured out a fix to clear up communications.
Eagle, Houston, we have you now. Do you read? Over.
Loud and clear.
Roger, we...
They gave Armstrong and Aldrin the go-ahead for their final descent.
Eagle, Houston, we read you now. You're a go for PDI. Over.
This was the start of the braking phase. The Eagle was falling at thousands of miles an hour. Firing their engine would create just enough upward thrust to slow down their descent. If perfectly timed, the engine burn would carry them down to the exact landing site that NASA had spent 2 years choosing, a patch of flat land surrounded by mountains and craters. But as they descended, Neil Armstrong noticed something. He knew exactly which landmarks he should be seeing based on the timing of their descent, and what he was seeing wasn't quite right.
And he realized that they were about 2 seconds early, and that translated into 2 miles of error in their landing point. So at that point, he told Mission Control, "We are probably going to land long."
They barely had time to process this realization when another problem pops up, an alarm.
1202.
How about two?
They didn't know what the alarm meant. All they saw on their computer display was the number 1202.
Armstrong and Aldrin had seen plenty of alarms in their flight simulations, and they almost always meant aborting the mission. But they never heard of a 1202. As it turned out, neither had mission control. After a few minutes of scrambling, they hunted down the computer guy, Jack Garman, who had a master list with all the alarm codes written on it.
So Jack Garman looks at his crib sheet, and he sees that it is a type of alarm called an executive overflow, which in common language means the computer is saying, look, guys, you've given me too many tasks. I've got too much on my to-do list. But I want you to know that if the alarm keeps coming up, I'm going to abort the mission.
It was nerve-wracking. But Garman knew that if the alarm didn't keep on recurring, if it was just a one-off, they'd be okay. So at this point, they're hurtling towards the moon's rocky surface, too fast and at the wrong angle, with an alarm sounding that could potentially shut down the whole system. The same system that was right now actually piloting the Eagle's descent. That prompted Neil Armstrong to test out his options.
He briefly checked his control stick to see that the craft was responsive in case he needed to take over semi-manual control later on.
The surface of the moon was growing brighter by now.
They're getting really close. And Armstrong, his attention up to this point has really been diverted. But now that the alarms have been resolved, he looks out the window again and he sees that the computer is steering them towards an enormous crater. It's the size of a football stadium. And it's ringed by boulders which are as big as small cars. And he, in typical test pilot fashion, understated fashion, he says to Aldrin over the intercom, pretty rocky area.
The whole reason for the computer to control their descent was because it was supposed to be more precise. But at this moment, it was steering them toward a crash landing in a crater. So Armstrong made a decision.
At that moment, he flipped a switch which allowed him to take semi-manual control of Eagle. And so they sped over the crater and began hunting for a safer spot.
In the meantime, Aldrin had started reading out their altitude and speed, all the instrument readings that Armstrong couldn't see with his eyes trained out the window.
2,000 feet, into the egg, 47 degrees, roger.
They whizzed just above the surface of the moon, looking for a place to land, conscious of the fact that every extra second ate up more of their limited fuel.
100 feet. 3.5 down, 9 forward.
If they ran out of fuel before finding a landing spot, it was an automatic abort.
Okay, 75 feet. Starts looking good, down a half. 6 forward.
Finally, Armstrong found a landing spot. But at 40 feet above the surface, a bunch of dust had kicked up, and Armstrong started losing his bearings.
He couldn't judge accurately his motion over the moon, whether he was going sideways or not, or perhaps drifting backwards.
4 forward. 4 forward. Drifting to the right a little. Down a half.
30 seconds of fuel left. They sank down lower and lower, waiting for the jolt of their landing. And then, suddenly, a little blue light on their console lit up.
Contact light.
And they settled to the ground so gently that neither of them felt the impact.
They shut off the engine. And just outside the window, Armstrong noticed something different and strange.
And he saw these dust particles streaking away in all directions in the vacuum of space and the moon's 1/6 gravity, and then suddenly everything was still. And he talked about that years later as something that just was absolutely amazing to see. Of course, no human being had ever seen dust blowing because of a rocket engine on the surface of an airless world like the moon.
They sat there for a second. And then Armstrong radioed down to mission control.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're looking good here.
Thank you.
Liz Tung reported that story. You're listening to Destination Moon. We're marking the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, talking about what got us to the moon and the challenges along the way. This daring mission had people all around the globe on the edge of their seats, following along, wondering if it would all work out. And we wanted to hear from all of you. How do you remember the moon landing?
My name is Kenneth Lacovara. I was 8 years old when I watched Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walk on the moon, and it really left an indelible impression in my young mind. And it filled me with hope, and it filled me with a desire to get out there and explore. And I felt like I would grow up in a new age, in the space age. And I did, and it's been amazing. And for me and a lot of scientists that are my age, that was the moment that really led us into exploration and this desire to discover what's out there.
Ken did discover what's out there. He went on to become a paleontologist, and he discovered the remains of one of the biggest dinosaurs to ever walk the Earth, Dreadnoughtus. Here's another moon memory from Joe DiOrio. He's in Nashville, Tennessee. He was 13 years old that summer on a cross-country road trip with his family, and he watched the moon landing in a cheap motel room in Zanesville, Ohio.
That day was the culmination of a 9-hour, 540-mile drive by my father. He and Mom were exhausted and just wanted my sister and I to shut off the television. "They're on the moon, okay? Now turn it off," Mom said. Good times.
Science got us to the moon and back.
You know, it was a remarkable engineering achievement. I would say the greatest engineering achievement of the 20th century.
But Eric Ward from the Linda Hall Library in Kansas City says, don't forget about the science that happened on the moon and then back on Earth after the missions were over.
The Apollo astronauts, you know, there were six successful lunar landing missions. The latter three missions had science as a priority. The Apollo astronauts brought back around a little over 840 pounds of lunar rock and soil sample.
Eric's library has one of those moon rocks on display right now.
It's a volcanic basalt that is approximately 3.8 billion years old.
Wow. What does it look like? How big is it?
Bigger than a marble, smaller than a golf ball. It's dark, dark gray, kind of brownish, reddish, dark gray.
Why do you think it's so important to have a sample like this, to put your eyeballs on a piece of the moon up close?
It makes it real. It makes the Apollo missions and the science that was done during those missions, it just brings it to life. You know, 1 minute I'm looking at a little rock that we have in our exhibition, and then later that night there I look at the moon and think about what a journey that rock has taken. It was up on the moon for 3.8 billion years until someone from Earth just happened to walk by, strike it with a hammer, and pick it up and bring it back to Earth. It's just incredible to me to think about.
What have scientists been able to learn from those samples? What have they focused on in their studies?
Probably the biggest science legacy to come from Apollo and the study of the sample has been a new hypothesis on the origin of the moon. And this new hypothesis emerged in the mid-1970s by planetary scientists William Hartman and Donald Davis. And they proposed that a Mars-sized asteroid impacted Earth around 4.0 billion years ago, and the ejected debris aggregated in Earth orbit to form the moon. And the giant impact scenario has, for the most part, gained widespread acceptance.
The samples collected on the moon allowed scientists to study similarities with Earth and differences. And it turns out the moon is a great place to study what happened a long, long time ago. Here's Jackie Faherty. She's an astronomer at the Museum of Natural History in New York City.
We've got this beautiful, thick atmosphere that allows us to breathe. The moon doesn't have that. And so stretched across the surface is this almost mummified version of what happened in the solar system. Because without an atmosphere, it means that everything that hit it got preserved. So it's gotten pummeled by things. Just look at the side of it. And so we use the moon in some ways to get an idea of the history of the solar system in general.
And that's why Jackie thinks it's so important that we continue to learn more about the moon, which she says is really not that far away.
I mean, if you think about it, some people have 250,000 miles on their car. You know, like when you have an old car, that's how many miles it is to the moon.
You're listening to Destination Moon, a special edition of The Pulse, marking the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission.
The exploration of space will go ahead, whether we join in it or not.
One of the big objectives with all of this was to beat the Russians to the moon. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin planted an American flag on the moon. It was a way to show the world that Americans got there first. But it did not mean that the U.S. could now lay claim to the moon itself. So whose moon is it anyway? Edward Saakashvili looked into this.
About 5 years ago, Sam Grubbs from Leicester, England, got a birthday gift from a colleague.
It came in a box. It's a brown A5 cardboard box. In the front it says 1 acre of land on the moon.
1 acre of land on the moon. Sam opened the box and inside there was the certificate.
It says, Lunar Deed. This document represents the transfer of 1 acre of land on the surface of the Earth's moon from Dennis M. Hope.
The land had been sold by a man called Dennis Hope, the alleged owner of the entire moon. And so Sam wondered,
who's Dennis and how did he become the owner of the moon?
Good question. So I tracked down Dennis Hope's real estate company. It's called the Lunar Embassy. They're the world's top sellers of land on the moon.
My name is Chris Lamar. I'm the CEO of Lunar Embassy and the acting president of the Galactic Government.
So why do they say they own the moon? Well, in 1980, Dennis Hope sent a letter to the UN stating that he was now the owner of the moon. The UN never responded, so Dennis just started selling the land. If you send $24.99 to the Lunar Embassy, they will send you a certificate for 1 acre of land on the moon. But Chris Lamar says some people have bought a lot more. They've paid over $25,000 for city-sized plots. Does that seem like a little bit too much? Does it seem fair to make somebody pay that much?
Well, yes, most definitely. I mean, it's the cheapest property in the whole solar system.
Cheap, maybe. But
legally, it's not possible to own a piece of the moon.
That's Claire Finkelstein. She's a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania and an expert in international law. I showed her the Lunar Embassy website, and she was horrified.
This is a very strange claim. They can't be anything but fraudulent.
Most space law experts agree. Claire cites the 1967 Space Treaty.
Article 2 says that outer space, including the moon and other celestial bodies, is not subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty, by means of use or occupation, or by any other means.
Basically, the treaty says space belongs to everyone. It's a global commons. And because governments can't control land on the moon, individuals can't own land on the moon. You need a government to recognize land ownership. So even if you have lots of certificates from the Lunar Embassy or other similar sites,
those claims will never be recognized.
So that should settle the question. Nobody owns the moon. But what Claire told me is that this idea that the moon and space belongs to everybody, it's increasingly in danger, not from shady real estate companies, but from governments.
There are serious threats on the part of countries to appropriate outer space.
Space is coming up in politics once again.
We are going to have the Air Force and we are going to have the Space Force.
The move to militarize space.
The militarization of space.
Concerns of a celestial arms race.
We must have American dominance in space, and so we will.
Countries like the U.S. and China are ramping up their interest in the moon and space again, for commercial and military reasons. If some of those ambitions turn into reality, Claire says, the Outer Space Treaty could collapse.
It is a concern. It is a concern.
And if the treaty collapses, lunar land ownership could become a thing. But that would be done by governments and big corporations, not the Lunar Embassy.
The Lunar Embassy is not a real embassy.
For The Pulse, I'm Edward Saakashvili.
This is Destination Moon. We're marking the 50th anniversary of the moon landing and Apollo 11. And we wanted to hear from all of you. What's your memory of that event, watching the footage on television? Elizabeth Fraser watched with her brothers and her father. He was a mathematician. Her mother had made cinnamon rolls for them all.
And one of the things that I remember is she had gotten these cool little cocktail toothpicks that had little flags on them, so we could kind of plant a flag on our cinnamon roll the way that they were going to plant a flag on the moon. And I remember my father trying to explain the trajectories and how it all worked. And I have to admit, my brothers and I did not pay a great deal of attention to his scientific explanations, but we all found it very exciting and a moment in history.
It's funny what leaves an impression in your mind when you're a kid, right? Where those little paper flags are pretty much just as cool as the moon landing itself. How do kids today think about the moon landing and what might be next in space exploration? Gail DeLauder went to find out. She started by chatting with second graders who live in NASA's backyard, Houston, Texas.
The students are imagining what it would be like if they could make the trip themselves. The plan begins with a moon base built from Legos. Evangeline Santana came up with a tiny rover that she says she'd use to transport any alien creatures they might find on the moon.
If there is life forms in it, or if it's water, it gives it to this guy to put in the water section of his body.
Evangeline attends the elementary school on the campus of the University of Houston.
He also carries food in here. Mostly what he gets is McDonald's.
Okay, where do you get McDonald's on the moon? Is there going to be a McDonald's on the moon someday?
No, because it goes back to the Earth, and it goes and get McDonald's, and then it goes to NASA and gets fuel.
That plan needs a little more work. But teacher Susan Lockwood says dreaming big is a good way to introduce kids to the realities of space travel.
When they have hands-on things to do, like building the moon with Legos, they learn a lot better, and then they come up with questions.
Next, I went to the Harmony School of Endeavor to hear from some middle schoolers. Gary Gordon is 14. He's lived his entire life in the digital age. He says it's pretty daunting to think about going to the moon with tech from the 1960s.
The computers would take up an entire room, but they had smaller data capacity than a regular phone, so they had to really, stretch out how many stuff they could do with that little data.
The astronauts dealt with a lot of unknowns. That's what grabbed Michelle Mai.
They can do like as much training as they want to do, but nothing will like really prepare them for the real thing.
Michelle's not sure if she would have handled it well.
Yeah, I would have cried. I would have been very stressed, and I would have like taken it out on people, because it's like it's so much responsibility and everyone's depending on you.
Meanwhile, it's the explorer's bravery that impresses Vanessa Tapia.
I think it was like very scary for the astronauts, and everyone thought it was impossible, which makes me think that anything is possible because everyone was saying that no one could do it, have so many conflicts, but they overcame all of those and they still got to go and everything went right, thankfully.
That story was reported by Gail DeLauter. People all over the world watched as the astronauts made their way toward the moon as they got there, and we wanted to hear from all of you. How do you remember this?
Hi, this is Nanette. In July of 1969, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Libya.
Nanette had been in a car crash in Libya and suffered serious injuries. She was eventually taken to an American hospital just outside of Tripoli. She recuperated there together with wounded soldiers flown in from Vietnam.
A combined group of us bruised and battered Americans gathered around a black and white TV to watch the moon landing and Neil Armstrong's historic step. I couldn't join the cheers because my broken jaw was wired shut, but I fully shared the feelings of pride and emotion of the moment.
Everybody we asked about their moon memories mentioned television, those grainy black and white images, and just being able to see this in real time.
CBS News presents
Man on the Moon, the epic journey of Apollo 11. Here from CBS News Apollo headquarters at Kennedy Space Center, correspondent Walter Cronkite.
Good morning. It's T-minus 1 hour, 29 minutes, and 53 seconds, and counting in just an hour and a half.
About 600 million people around the world tuned in. Ingrid Ockert studies science and the media at the Science History Institute in Philadelphia, and she says NASA understood the power of television.
Television was this wonderful eye into the whole process of exploration for the viewer at home. It was really important to continue to have the input and the buy-in of an audience to help propel the current mission and keep the missions going.
So they added a camera to the Eagle, even though that meant extra weight.
So what you had was a black and white camera that was attached to the outside of the lunar module. And that was only going to be turned on when Armstrong and Aldrin were actually walking.
That's not a whole lot of footage from the actual mission, but the networks had hours of broadcasts to fill.
NASA was beaming the audio back and forward, and they had, you know, 30 hours worth of audio. But it's TV. You can't have audio and not have a visual. And so CBS and ABC actually paid a considerable amount of money to have props of an actual full-scale model of the lunar modules and the surface of the moon, actually.
We're going to attempt to give our audience an idea topographically on the moon.
CBS and ABC hired actors to wear astronaut costumes and in real time recreate what it would look like inside the lunar module.
The lunar module cutting itself free from the command module, beginning the maneuvers which should place it on the surface of the moon.
And they hired special effects artists who had worked with Kubrick for Space Odyssey 2001 and animators who had worked with Disney on the earlier Man in Search of Space series to come up with animations of what the descent would look like.
And this was on television during...
This was on television. And so what would happen was when they were showing these visuals on screen, CBS and ABC would have some words on screen that would say, this is a simulation, this is not real. And some historians of science have speculated that this confusion between the simulated images of man on the moon and the actual footage of man on the moon is part of the reason that following the broadcast, of course, there were stories that there was a hoax.
Armstrong is on the moon. Neil Armstrong, 38-year-old American, standing on the surface of the moon.
How much did television and the way in which this enormous event was broadcast influence our perception of it, our memory of it?
I think it would not be the same if we didn't have the footage. And I would say it wouldn't be the same if we hadn't had the medium in the moment that we had the medium. If we think about the ways that people watch TV in the 1960s, we have a culture where people are all tuning in and watching TV at the same time and to watch the same thing. And I think it was a shared positive feeling at a point where a lot of people were scared about what was going to happen, and they were looking for something positive to focus on.
That's Ingrid Ockert from the Science History Institute in Philadelphia.
Well, for thousands of years now, it's been man's dream to walk on the moon. Right now, after seeing it happen, knowing that it happened, it still seems like a dream.
Go ahead, Mr. President. This is Houston out.
The race to get to the moon brought together the brightest minds in science, engineering, technology, but the spark that really started this great mission was politics. Space exploration and politics have had a long and complicated relationship. Alan Yu has more.
Landing on the moon seemed like the pinnacle of human achievement. And to this day, people wonder, if we went to the moon in the 60s and created this moment that united all of humanity, why is it taking this long to go back? Vice President Mike Pence posed this question earlier this year at a meeting of the National Space Council.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Vice President of the United States.
He was wondering why NASA had told him it would take till 2028 to get back to the moon.
It took us 8 years to get to the moon the first time, 50 years ago, when we had never done it before. And it shouldn't take us 11 years to get back.
We don't have the political will that provides the money to do it. It's not much more complicated than that.
That's Casey Dreyer. His official title is Senior Space Policy Advisor and Chief Advocate at the Planetary Society, a foundation that promotes space science and exploration. But really, he's the biggest space fan, and his job is to get people excited about space.
Space.
It's also really important to remember why Apollo happened in the first place wasn't because of some idealistic, soaring vision of exploration.
When we remember the Apollo missions, we remember Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins, and this legendary speech from President John F. Kennedy.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
And Kennedy was ready to spend a lot of money on this.
This year's space budget is three times what it was in January 1961, and it is greater than the space budget of the previous 8 years combined. That budget now stands at $5.4 billion a year.
That was 1960s money. It would be more than $45 billion now.
The reason why Kennedy put the money in wasn't because he was a big space fan. He is on record as saying he couldn't care that much less about space.
Because I'm not that interested in space. I think it's good. I think we ought to know about it. We're ready to spend.
He said, like, if I could have done this big spectacular thing and solved water desalination, I would have done that instead of Apollo. The only reason he committed the resources to Apollo that he did was that he saw Apollo as a front in the Cold War.
That we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend.
This is war by another means.
Oppose any foe to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
It remains that it was seen as a national security prerogative, and it was funded as such, right? In terms of how much money was spent and how quickly, you really don't see expenditures like that happen except for warfare in democracies.
The big spending boost that NASA got went away not long after Neil Armstrong and the other astronauts came back. President Richard Nixon welcomed Armstrong and the Apollo 11 crew back in 1969. And there were six more Apollo missions. But by the very next year, in 1970...
he cut NASA's budget by a huge amount and no longer said that NASA was a special program. It just wasn't worth the effort. That human spaceflight would be a regular part of government and it would compete for government resources like every other aspect.
Poppy Northcutt worked at Mission Control during the Apollo program.
You know, it's a pleasant memory, there's no doubt about that, but also sort of sad and bittersweet, too.
She says NASA already had plans for more ambitious missions to the moon and Mars, and she wishes they could have done those, too.
In Congress's mind, and perhaps in the public mind as well, they viewed it as a race with the Russians, and once the race with the Russians was won, there's not anything more to do.
So the government cut NASA's budget, and it stayed low for decades. And NASA's crewed space missions stayed in low Earth orbit ever since, which is about 1,000th of the way from here to the moon.
Hello from the International Space Station.
So it's kind of like going a few blocks instead of traveling across the country. Then, in 2003, the Space Shuttle Columbia was destroyed above Earth's atmosphere. All seven crew members died.
Their mission was almost complete, and we lost them so close to home.
After that disaster,
it provided a moment for the White House and a lot of other folks in government and Congress to reflect on, why do we send humans into space? Why are they risking their lives? What are they going to achieve out of it?
Columbia's last mission was to carry equipment for science experiments on spaceflight and microgravity. After that massive setback, George W. Bush came up with a new, bold mission for NASA, perhaps with the thought that if we're going to put lives at risk with space exploration, we might as well shoot for the moon.
Our third goal is to return to the moon by 2020. as the launching point for missions beyond.
They called the program Constellation. The idea was to go back to the moon, live and work on the lunar surface, and eventually go further.
With the experience and knowledge gained on the moon, we will then be ready to take the next steps of space exploration, human missions to Mars and to worlds beyond.
Constellation was a program to return us to the moon. It was variously described as Apollo on steroids or going back to the moon to stay.
The people at NASA got to work on a bigger rocket, a lunar lander three times bigger than the one for the Apollo missions. Neil Armstrong was on the moon for a few hours. This one would stay a full week. NASA built a life-sized mock-up for testing. They had a three-step design process. The lander has to do the most basic job, get to the moon and back. And it has to keep the astronauts safe. And only then do they think about what do we add that would help the astronauts succeed in their missions. In 2008, Eugene Cernan, the last astronaut to walk on the moon, came to visit.
Hey guys, this is Gene Cernan.
NASA had gotten so far in the design process that this was his advice to Kathy Lorini, the project manager for the lunar lander.
Hey, make sure you provide coffee. When you're on these missions, you're far away from Earth. You're roughing it up. You don't have a great place to sleep. It's hard to go to the bathroom. What would really have been nice was to be able to wake up in the morning and have a nice hot cup of coffee.
This sounds kind of funny now, but Kathy says it actually tells us people had spent a lot of time on the lander.
When we got to the point of what do we need to do to ensure the mission is successful?
It's time for the percolator.
There were still people on my team that said, we can't afford the mass of a coffee maker. And others, like myself, who said, come on, we have to find a couple of kilograms to be able to launch a coffee maker.
So they were really far along. It came as a total shock to them when the Obama administration canceled Constellation in 2010. There's this moment in the press conference with Charles Bolden, the NASA administrator at the time, when you can hear his voice crack and he is visibly holding back tears.
To people who are working on these programs, this is like a death in the family. So, everybody needs to understand that. And we need to give them time to grieve, and then we need to give them time to recover.
A new president can mean different priorities for the human spaceflight program at NASA every 4 or 8 years. Casey Dreyer says that can be incredibly frustrating.
Because we have to start anew every couple of years and we lose the effort and momentum that we've had.
George W. Bush promised an Apollo-sized program, but he could not pair it with Apollo-sized funding.
The political support for that initiative never really materialized. And by the time the Obama administration came in, they were looking at a program that was billions of dollars over budget, years behind schedule, and it was unclear what level of success they could expect out of that and when.
After that, Casey says NASA got smart.
We're building a big rocket. We're building a crew capsule that can stay out in space for a long time.
NASA decided to build things that would kind of work regardless of where the next president wants to go.
Yeah, you can send it to the moon, you can probably send it to an asteroid, maybe through some modifications you can send things to Mars, but you don't need to start over every 4 years. You're seeing actually quite a bit of this with the Obama to Trump transition, where even though the destination changed from asteroid/Mars to moon, none of the actual programs themselves at NASA were canceled because of that.
And there's something else NASA doesn't like to talk about, because it removes the romance of space travel. The human spaceflight program is a giant job creation program, and that is what politicians care about.
There's a reason that the Apollo testing grounds for giant rockets were down in Mississippi, because one of the senators of Mississippi was on the Appropriations Committee in the Senate that paid for this program to happen at the time in the 1960s.
Casey says NASA and the space industry create jobs. They shouldn't be shy about it. It's part of the big picture, and it's how we can pay for space exploration.
This is the system that we have in the United States. How do you work in that system to advance things that are really ambitious and idealistic and frankly beautiful? And what other government agency has fans like this. You don't see the Department of Agriculture having people call themselves agriculture fanatics.
People buy NASA t-shirts and pins and hats because space exploration is cool. That's why we make movie after movie about the astronauts, the gripping human drama, life and death stakes, but we don't watch movies about the politics of paying for that stuff.
NASA is one of the purest expressions of human curiosity that we see in the entire world.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. One of the people we heard from in Alan's story is retired rocket scientist Poppy Northcutt. She is featured in the new American Experience documentary, Chasing the Moon, on PBS.
I just remember looking around at these guys thinking, I think I might be able to do what these guys are doing. They're making a whole lot more money than I am, and their job seems more interesting.
Poppy says, given that we were ready to start working on getting to Mars in the 1970s, we have to get back out there, to the moon and beyond. And if somebody said to you, why? You know, there are all these other problems that we need to solve on Earth, hunger, climate change, a thousand things. Why space? What would you say to them?
I would say there will always be all of those problems. And also that we as human beings have always been, it's in our DNA to explore and to try to find out what we don't know, to go into the unknown. And going into the unknown and doing that exploration has always ended up being pretty beneficial overall. So we as human beings have a longing, a hunger to explore. But we also have a need to explore, because as we explore, we develop more technology and better technology. Doing this exploration, maybe we may find the answer to our climate problems as we do more exploration.
Astronaut Buzz Aldrin wants us to get to Mars, and he puts his hopes for future space exploration in four simple words.
To land and stay.
You've been listening to Destination Moon, a special production of The Pulse at WHYY. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
The name of the rabbit is not reported.
Our reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Avir Mitra contributed to our reporting. Tanya English edited stories for this show.
Okay, now we've got some things to do.
Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.